Seems like you just can't make the walk down that aisle fast enough. As we begin tonight, we kind of pick up our text at a very interesting time in Israel's history. We're in the divided kingdom here in 1 Kings. We've gone through about 200 years of Israel's history to get to where we are right now. They've been through about 19 kings to this point. Beginning with Jeroboam. There's a very interesting thread woven through all of these kings as you read their stories, as you read their actions, whether they were good kings, whether they were bad kings. I know we talk about that a lot in the junior high class. Were they good? Were they bad? How long did they reign? Most of their reigns weren't very long. And at the end of their lives, after they died, it usually says that so-and-so followed in the way of Jeroboam. They caused Israel to do all of the sins that Jeroboam caused them to sin. If that doesn't speak of the legacy that we leave in our lives, I don't know what does. But it began with Jeroboam causing Israel to sin. And here, actually just the chapter before 17, we find chapter 16. And towards the end of that chapter, we find the latest king in the string of Israel kings, and his name is Ahab. Ahab was a special guy because not only did he cause Israel to sin and follow after everything that Jeroboam started, but he did more. Now, the verses go like this. Bobby? I think. That's what I get for not writing it on my paper. There it is. Chapter 16 and verses 30, it says this, that Ahab, the son of Omri, did even more open evil before God than anyone yet. A new champion in evil. It wasn't enough for him to copy the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat. He made the God of Israel angrier than all the previous kings of Israel put together. All right, this is the first time that we see this. He did more to make God angry. He caused Israel to do more sin than any of the kings before him. 200 years, 19 kings, and this guy does more than all of them put together. That's quite the record. Can you imagine what it was like to be living in Israel at this time? All of the stuff that must have been going on, all of the idol worship that was there, the adultery that was being committed, the corruption that was within the government, the scandals that were going on. And finally God says enough. He says, Israel, I've had enough of you. And he decides to do something about it. And most of the time when I'm thinking about this, when I'm trying to think through this, I think, okay, God is going to raise up an army. He's going to send one of the other nations that Israel's fighting against all the time. That's who he's going to send. But he doesn't do that. God raises up one single man. This actually seems to be a trend, doesn't it? He's raised up Moses. He's raised up Joseph. Later he raises Jesus. One single man to rescue Israel. I like to think of myself as a pretty brave individual. There's not much that really scares me, that really bothers me. I'm generally the one that's elected in the middle of the night to get up out of bed and go see what that noise was, or to go see what the dogs are barking at, which is like an every night occurrence. And so, you know, I get out of bed, and like any brave person, I grab the little miniature baseball bat that I have sitting next to the nightstand. And I go walking through the house looking for whatever made that noise, trying to figure out what the dogs are barking about. They have this uncanny ability to pick out the guy that for some reason about midnight decides to walk his dog down the street. I don't know why he does this. But they'll be in the garage. They can't see anything. They don't know what's going on. But they know that he's there. It absolutely blows my mind. One of the things I don't like, though, is when I'm home with my mom and dad, when I was growing up, I didn't like the dark out on the farm because it was dark like nothing that I've ever been a part of in my life. And there was the one big lamp or the one big street light that was there in the yard, but it didn't go very far. It didn't go far enough out to the water where you had to go out and turn it off in the middle of the night to make sure that it didn't overflow. That was a scary thing. Another thing that I hate is confrontation. I'm not a very confrontational person. I'm generally not brave enough to sit there and speak my mind. I'm not generally brave enough to take a stand on some things, unless you're really, really pushing me. Where we pick up our story here in chapter 17 and verse 1, this is one of the most incredible statements, I think, that I've seen in all of Scripture. It says that Elijah, who was from Tishbe, but had settled in Gilead, said to Ahab, "I solemnly swear, as the Lord God of Israel, whom I serve, lives, there will be no dew or rain during the next few years unless I say so." Can you kind of grasp what's going on here? If we were watching like a scary movie, this would be the part where the music gets real intense. Elijah has just done a very bold thing. He's walked into the king and said, "All right, this is how it's going to be." If we try to put it into a little bit of context, basically what he's pronounced on Israel is a complete economic shutdown, isn't it? You know, right now we think, you know, we've got it bad because we're in an economic slowdown. Can you imagine what it would be like for everything to shut down? For this economy, for the agricultural society that they were, for no rain to fall for months, for years, would be to absolutely shut them down. And it's at this point in the story that God does something interesting. When Elijah steps up and makes such a bold statement, I almost get, you know, we're getting ready for the fight. We're getting ready for the climax of the story where something big happens to resolve it. But that's not exactly how it happens, is it? I'm expecting that Elijah is going to be able to do whatever he wants to do. You know, he's a prophet of God. He can perform all the miracles. He can call down fire from heaven if he wants to. But God takes Elijah. We see God putting him through an intense time of preparation. An intense time of getting him ready to serve. To make Elijah perhaps the man that God needs him to be. This actually is the first time that we see Elijah in all of Scripture. He's walked into the presence of the king. He's made a big claim. He's done a great thing as far as the prophets go. And we're thinking, man, Elijah's got it, doesn't he? God's behind him. But God still needs to work in him just a little bit more. God still needs to work on his heart. He needs to work in him so that he can work through him. God is about to use Elijah in a very incredible way. But first he needed to teach him a few things. He takes him here through about three different periods that I believe are meant to prepare Elijah for the journey ahead, to get him ready for the things that he's about to go to. The first one we're going to pick up right there in verse 2 as we're reading. Verse 1, Elijah comes in, he says, "No rain." Verse 2, God says to him, "Leave here, turn eastward, and hide in the Kerith Ravine, east of the Jordan." This is an interesting place, this Kerith Ravine. This is the first period that God is going to put him through. And I like to call it this, the period of isolated pain. Because this ravine east of the Jordan is a very desolate place. Not much there. Not much going on. Not really anybody to talk to. It's a very isolated place. It keeps you away from everybody. He, at this point, is all alone. Can you imagine having walked in to the presence of the king and made this huge announcement, and then God says, "I want you to go off by yourself. I want you to take some time. I want you to be alone." He's got no one to turn to. He doesn't have any friends to lean on at this point. He is completely alone. The word Kerith means to cut off or to cut down, like to cut off from the source, or to cut down like you would a tree. You can almost hear God saying here to Elijah, not quite yet. There you go. You can almost hear God saying to Elijah, "Elijah, I need to break you. I need to cut you down to humble you. I need to teach you to be totally and completely dependent on me. I need to humble you in a private way so that I can take you and use you later in a very public way. I think this is a time that a lot of people can relate to, probably in this auditorium right now. Maybe you're at this moment when it feels like nothing is going right, where it feels like you just can't win for losing. You can't get your feet on the ground. You just can't get going. And it's times like this in our lives when we start to doubt God, isn't it? We start to wonder if He really cares, if He's really there for us. We start to wonder, where is God? Why wasn't He here when that happened to me? Why wasn't He taking care of me? Why wasn't He watching over me? But the reality is that He's right there all the time. It's like this little bird that was flying south for the winter. This has become one of my new favorite stories. I thought I'd share it with you. It's a little bit gross, it's a little bit sad, and it's a little bit funny. Everything that you need to really make a good story, I think. But there was this little bird. He got a late start. He was flying south for the winter. He got a late start. And as he was flying, he got caught in a snowstorm. One of the worst snowstorms in history, with hail and ice. And it got to the point where he couldn't fly anymore because the ice, it was building up on his wings. A very sad picture, isn't it? And the little bird, finally, he just can't do it anymore. And he makes a crash landing in a field. And he's just there, and the sleet and the ice is just, you can just picture it bouncing off of his head almost. And he's sitting there just thinking to himself, this is the worst thing ever. The worst thing that could possibly happen to me. I'm not going to make it. I'm going to die right here in the middle of this field. And finally, as he's preparing himself to die, a creature comes. The cow comes and stands over him. And the cow does what cows do, all over the little bird. And there the bird is sitting in this pile of manure and thinking, man, when it can't get any, just when you think it can't get worse, it usually does, right? But in the course of things, the warmth of the manure starts to thaw his little wings, and he starts to have a change of heart and thinking a little bit more positively, where he says, I can get out. I'm going to be able to do this. You know, as the ice melts off his wings, and you can see him as he breaks free and he starts to flap his wings and he's chirping just out of pure joy. And then all of a sudden, one of the devil's creatures comes along. It's a cat. He sees the little bird and he eats the bird and he kills the bird. The bird's done. The end of his life, right there in the middle of this field. Three very important lessons from this point in time. Not everyone who drops manure on you is your enemy. And not everyone who digs you out is your friend. And when you're in manure, you need to keep your big mouth shut. Some of you might be in this ravine right now, this Kerith ravine, saying to yourself, I feel so broken, I feel so alone, I don't have anything to depend on anymore. You feel like you're being cut down every single day. But what we have to understand, I think that sometimes God is saying, I'm working inside you. I'm preparing you for something much bigger than yourself, much bigger than you can imagine right now at this point in your life. I'm teaching you something that you couldn't learn any other way so that I can do more through you. You're having to go through these trials right now, but there's something better, I promise. Some of you are there, but I want to suggest to you that you could be there on purpose. That you're there for a reason. And if you're there, I want to ask you to not lose heart, to not give up. The second thing that we find God as he's teaching Elijah these valuable lessons, I think we're a couple of slides. There you go. Comes in verses 4, 5, and 6, where he says, you can drink from the stream, and I've commanded the ravens to feed you there. Elijah left and did what the word of the Lord had told him. He went to live by the Kerith River, which is east of the Jordan River. Ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and in the evening, and he drank from the stream. God at this point is teaching Elijah the second major lesson that he needed to learn, which is that of total dependence. God has brought him to a very unique place, especially during a drought, during a time where no rain is falling. God has brought him to the Kerith Ravine, and it, of all places, has water. And it's going to be one of the few places during the drought where the water actually lasts, which I think is a miracle of God. God has brought him to the water. The second part of this, we see God's catering service. The birds are bringing him food, bringing him the meat and the bread that he needs to get him through. They bring it directly to the prophet. What is God doing? What is God doing here? God, I believe, is clearly saying that I will be faithful to you. You can count on me to provide for you. When you get in those times when you don't have anybody to lean on, I'll be there for you. Some of us are in this place. The things that we used to depend on, the things that we relied on, they're all gone. They've been taken away from us. We don't have anything left to turn to. You have nothing left to trust in but the one who gives life. The one God who has the power to give life. You're having to learn that when everything else is gone, God will be faithful. He says, I will be your provider. When you can't depend on what you're used to, I will deliver that to you. The coolest thing here is that God didn't give him 3 days worth of food, did he? He didn't give him a month's worth of food. He didn't give him like the giant Sam's Club portion of food, did he, all at one time? God gave him enough for the day. He gave him bread and meat in the morning. He gave him bread and meat in the evening. One of the best lessons that we could ever learn in life is this, isn't it? It's that God gives us enough for the day. When we're hurting, when we're alone, when we're afraid, God gives us enough for the day. When we're uncomfortable, God is our comfort. We may not have much, but God says, I will be your provision for the day. When we're weak, God is our strength. When all of our friends walk out, God will be your friend for that day. God is humbling Elijah. He's cutting him down. He won't bring more than we need, but he does bring exactly what we need. He says, Elijah, I will be your daily bread. God teaches Elijah to depend on him for that day. When Elijah can't provide for himself, God is teaching him that he will always be his provider. And God will always be our provider as well. The third thing that we read about here comes in the next couple of verses, verse 7. It says, but after some time the stream dried up because no rain had fallen on the land. Then the Lord spoke his word to Elijah. He says, get up, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and stay there. All of a sudden, we're going along through the story. We're going great. And God says, go to the ravine. Elijah says, all right. God says, depend on me. Elijah says, okay. And all of a sudden, our story gets turned upside down, doesn't it? Put yourselves in Elijah's place. You have spent months here in this ravine. You have spent months learning to depend on God. God sent him here. God has been taking care of him here. And all of a sudden, it's dry. If you're the prophet, what's going through your mind right now? I know if I was Elijah, I'd be sitting there thinking, okay, God, where are you? What's the point? You gave me water and now it's gone. Is there something that I've missed? Is there something that I've done wrong? Have I missed you in all of this? I don't understand. Why would the source of what's been keeping me alive all of a sudden dry up? I think that Elijah is about to learn that the same God who can give water can also take that water away. Because God may cause our brook to dry up, to give us enough courage to leave where we are and go where we're supposed to be. Have you ever found yourself in this particular place? The things that you used to be able to depend on are drying up. The job that you used to have, the job that you had faith in, confidence in, all of a sudden isn't such a sure thing anymore. The friends that you used to lean on, that brook is drying up. You know, I used to have a good marriage, a marriage that I thought would last, but now that brook is starting to dry up. I used to be close to God. We used to know each other personally, but that brook is drying up. You know, it's been said this way, that many times God provides or guides by what He provides. God had been guiding Elijah to this point so far. He provided the ravine. He provided this safe haven for Elijah to be able to hide out, for Elijah to be able to learn the lessons that he needed. But I think we also need to learn another valuable lesson here. I think sometimes that God guides by what He doesn't provide. When we spend so much time in prayer asking God for this, and we're getting nothing. It's been weeks, it's been months, sometimes years, and we're still getting nothing. I think that sometimes God is trying to tell us something. That the God who gives water may cause that brook to dry up, to give us enough courage to take a step out into complete and total obedience. This gives the courage to be obedient, even sometimes when it doesn't make sense. He teaches us to trust Him when it doesn't make sense to us. When sometimes we're sitting there wondering, God, where were you? Where are you? He's there, and He's teaching us. How many of you are familiar with the Karate Kid movies? It's one of my favorite movies. They're doing a remake of it, and I'm not sure how I feel about that. But Daniel wants to learn how to fight, so he says, Mr. Miyagi, teach me how to fight. And Mr. Miyagi, he says, okay, I teach you, you know, how to fight. He says, first lesson. You know, you can just picture him so jazzed up to learn the karate, and Mr. Miyagi says, paint my fence. Okay, maybe a little confused at this point, but he goes out and he starts, you know, painting the fence. And Mr. Miyagi comes out and corrects him, doesn't he? He says, no, you're doing it wrong. And he shows him how to do it. You do it hard. You do it quick. The next lesson comes in, wax my car. And you're still going, I don't know about this guy, but okay. And so he's there, he's wax on, wax off. And Mr. Miyagi comes over and says, no, that's not how you do it. Wax on, wax off, right? And it's still, I mean, it's not making much sense. In the third lesson, he says, scrub my floor. And so Daniel, at this point, I would be getting incredibly frustrated, as I think he was. He goes in and he starts just scrubbing the floor, you know, like most of us would at this point, probably about half-heartedly. And Mr. Miyagi comes in and he takes it from him and says, no, and, you know, this is how you do it. As he's there and as he's teaching him to scrub that floor. And finally, it all comes to a head where Daniel has had enough and he just doesn't know what to do anymore. And he's like, what is the point? And it's this time that Mr. Miyagi takes him. He says, okay, it's time to fight. And he throws a punch at him. And he messes it up. And he says, paint the fence. And so when he does like this, he's able to block the punch. He says, wax my car. And when he does that waxing motion, that's what blocks the punches. Sometimes it doesn't make sense, the situations that we're in our lives. But once we're there, sometimes the light bulb comes on. And it makes a little bit more sense. It all comes together finally. It's like that point in time where it just clicks. God tells Elijah to go. God tells Elijah to be fed by the ravens, and you can see him going, okay. And all of a sudden the brook dries up, and you can even hear him going, all right, God, you know, what's going on now? And God does something interesting here. He sends Elijah to Zarephath, where his newfound dependence on God serves him very well. If you remember the story, he approaches the widow lady. He humbles himself in front of her and he says, "You know what, ma'am? I'm very thirsty. And can you give me something to drink? And can you give me a snack?" And you can imagine probably the look on her face as she looks at him and says, "Are you crazy? Don't you know there's been a drought going on for years now? We don't have water. I don't have enough to get us through this. I'm going home actually to make the last cakes for us to eat, and then we're going to die." But Elijah calls on his newfound faith in God, on his newfound trust in God, doesn't he? He says, "No, everything will be all right." She gives him the water and bakes him the cake, and for the rest of the drought, the meal that she has never runs out. A few months later, we see that her son dies, and she calls on Elijah, and Elijah comes back, and we see him again using the faith that he found there in that ravine to bring that son back to life, because up until this point, we've never seen that done in Scripture. We've never seen that done. So he comes and he prays. He says, "God, I know you can do this. You taught me to depend on you. I'm going to do that now. I want you to, you know, raise this child." Sometimes God has to break us down to be able to use us better. Sometimes God has to work on our insides before he can use us outwardly. I don't know where you guys are right now at this point in your lives. I mean, are you in the ravine right now? Are you in that desolate, awful place? Maybe we're being taught to be obedient in our lives, to depend on God. Those things are being taken away from us. Or are you noticing that maybe some of the brooks in your life are starting to dry up? There's one thing that I know for sure that will get us through, and that's God. He always gives us just enough. Enough for the day, enough to get us through. If there's anything that we can do tonight, if